toy maker, are you?
I am.
Then it's you to blame, is it, for toys that won't play? Shame on you, sir. They were only boys. They wanted nothing more than a game. And all this while our boys are still fighting out there.
The man would brook no further questions. The crowd parted to allow him through, unwittingly closing ranks as Emile sought to follow. By the time they fanned out back into the aisles, the customer was gone. Emile stared after him, searching for footprints in the confetti snow. He turned to see Kathy packing the soldiers away. "Let me see them." Kathy stood in silence as he wound the soldiers up, deployed them, and watched them broker their peace.
"It's him," said Emile, unable to speak his brother's name.
Kathy touched him on the arm. "You don't know that."
"Oh, but I do. He waltzed in and made his declaration, and now he's done this. He's done it to spite me. And all because I..."
Emile hesitated before saying the words. But Kathy heard them all the same.
"Because I wasn't there." "It's sabotage. That's what it is." "Well, we've had saboteurs before. We'll see about..."
He was on the verge of striding through the counter and into the warren of stores and antechambers above, when Kathy said,
"Emile, let me go to him."
Emile was about to say no, when a trio of boys tumbled out of the aisles with boxes of the Long War in their arms.
"Sir," announced the first, "it's these ones too. We were playing in the glade, but they wouldn't work. We thought they were broken until that man..."
Emile fell to one knee and took the new soldiers in his hands.
"What use is a soldier if he won't do battle?"
He opened the mechanism of the first soldier, as if he might find the answer inside, and while he was ferreting within, Kathy slipped into the shadows behind the counter. Moments later, past the register and up the spiralling stair, she was standing in front of Casper, the patchwork rabbits having proliferated around his feet. Martha crouched among them, feeding scraps of fabric to one of the tiny kits.
"Martha, might I speak to your father?"
"Oh, yes, Mama."
"Alone." Martha scooped a selection of rabbits into her arms and, with a vengeful glare, tramped out of the room.
"Casper, tell me it truthfully. Have you tinkered?" She could find no better word for it. "With soldiers on the shop floor." Casper's lips parted in a smile.
"Casper?"
"It's you who told me, Kathy, that I had to do it. That it had to come from me. Well, my love, this is how. You understand, don't you? Why, it has to be this way. Because they weren't going to listen. They all look at me like I'm an intruder. Well, this is my home. And, Kathy, all I want is to come back."
"Casper, here you are. Here."
"Emile was never going to listen. He's wanted to win the Long War ever since we were boys. Well, now there'll be no winner. Now it can end. And this emporium, this place we have, it can live again." At that moment, the workshop door flew open. Patchwork rabbits scattered for the shelter of shelves and upturned crates. Emile stood in the doorway, his cheeks bunched and red.
"What did you do?" he breathed. "Tell me what you did."
Casper lifted a consolatory hand. "Let me show you, little brother." A toy soldier was lying inert on the floor by Casper's feet. The cavity in its back was still open, so Casper tinkered within. What adjustments he was making, Emile did not know, yet when he set the soldier down, suddenly it wouldn't march. Emile wound it up, but instead of sallying forth, it folded its legs and took a seat. Then, with sinking inevitability, the key stopped turning.
"It's supposed to march. They form a unit, so boys can play battles against each other."
"Oh, yes," sighed Casper, and win a few square feet of carpet for every 10 soldiers lost. His eyes darkened. I told you, little brother, the Emporium isn't to sell toy soldiers any more. We are, none of us, butchers. So why must we raise our children that way? Emile snatched the recalcitrant soldier in his fist. 3 years his brother had been gone, and if, in those years, Caspar had seen and done things of which Emile might never know, well, that did not make Emile's own years worthless. He had Nina. The long war was a triumph. He was to be a father, a real father. And the Emporium did not belong to Caspar. It belonged to them all, to their families, and... damn it, Caspar. What do you want from me? To Caspar, the answer was so banal, there was no point in asking the question. I want you to grow up. I deserve more than that, Caspar. Well, Kathy, don't I? You fought your war, but I kept our Emporium afloat, didn't I? I did it in the only way I knew how, and my soldiers, they're... everything. He had started out softly, but now his voice reached new heights. The Long War is our best-selling toy. That's what boys want. Soldiers to put on their shelves and think of their fathers. Little tin tanks that can roll up and down on their tracks. Cavalry and artillery wagons. Boys come here for them. Girls, too. They take them home and collect them and make battles and come back for more. The Emporium might have sunk without you, Caspar. Papa slowing down and you gone for so long and... give me one reason, just one, why you've any right to waltz back here and end it all. Caspar levered himself to his feet, refusing the offer of Kathy's hand. When he spoke, white spittle flew from his lips. Haven't you ever thought how it might feel? 2 battalions of these things, all wound up and marching at each other, and then they fall down and get picked back up and have to do the whole thing all over again, dancing to somebody else's tune. These soldiers don't get a choice. It doesn't end for them, Emile. They don't even get the sanctity of death. Caspar, Emile said, more softly now, trying to cross the expanse between his brother and him in awkward, stuttering steps. You're home now. They're only toys. They can't feel. The look on Caspar's face was incredulous. Emile might as well have told him there were no stars in the night sky, that their mamma still lived and walked among them. Didn't Papa teach you anything? He asked. And there they stood, each one staring into the other, while on the shop floor beneath, 100 disappointed voices began to make themselves heard. Imaginarium. Papa Jack's Emporium, 1918. Dawn, and the aisles of Papa Jack's Emporium lay in wild disarray. Had you been there that night, had you crouched on one of the galleries and peered through the rails as Martha Godman did, you might have thought that the crooked servants of London's ordinary toy shops had come to lay the Emporium to waste. But had you looked more closely, you would have seen 2 familiar figures toiling in the gloom, Emile and his wife Nina, whirling together in the long war glade as they tore open every box, shredded every soldier's wrapping and set them to march. Now, in every corner of the glade, toy soldiers shook hands and agreed an armistice, rather than raise their rifles or even march on. As the dawn's first light spilled over the cloud castle turrets, waking the patchwork Pegasi from their roosts, Emile sank to his haunches and laughed, laughed in wild despair. Pack them all up. Wake Francis Kesey and all of the rest. If one of these soldiers leaves the Emporium today, the shop hand who sells it is finished. Nina went to console him,
and for a moment Emil let himself be smothered in her arms. Then he took off into the darkness of the untended aisles. Follow. Up, up, and up. Emil Godman might have run ungainly, but he could run when he needed to. Into the shadows of mammoths, through the log piles where paper trees had been felled, patchwork dogs and cats watched him from their enclosures. The runnerless rocking horses stopped grazing in their corrals and wondered at his flight. After a long night's labor, Emil was too tired for the endless stairs, so he clambered into a dirigible balloon, heaved its tethers out of the earth, and soared up, up, up into the dome above the shop floor. From the gallery rail, Martha watched him hurtle past, then lost him in the reef of mist on which the cloud castle sat. By the time he reached the Emporium Terrace, he was quite out of breath. Great billows of white curled through his nostrils as he burst onto the rooftop where his papa's garden spilled out of chimney pots and terracotta, rising up through dislodged tiles. From here you could see the world. A single snowflake pirouetted down to land in the hair of Emil's naked arm. Snowflakes. Snowflakes all around. But of snowdrops, there was no sign. Chest burning, he crouched down, pressed his fingers to the earth. He was searching for color, for a speck of green, anything that might convince. The bulbs were down there, down where they hid all summer long. And if there truly was magic in the Emporium, if this thing they called magic existed at all, then surely it would call itself forth now. Surely a snowdrop would rise from the earth and open itself to reveal a perfect bell of white. But no magic came for Emil. No magic had ever come for him at all. He pressed his fingers through the frost-hardened earth, delved down until the dirt grew thick in his fingernails, riming the creases of his hands. It was, he realized with a sense of revelation, delicious to be doing something so untoward. He risked a look over his shoulder, but in the Godman's quarters all was still. Then, back to his task. His fingers found what they were looking for. He pulled his hand back, trailing a snowdrop bulb and all of its roots. It had already started to shoot, struggling for the surface. Now that the crime was done, and all his adrenaline spent, Emil hurried to hide the misdeed. He flattened the earth beneath his boot, scraped the soil from his hand, and hurried inside. Perhaps Mrs. Horning would notice the boot prints he left behind him, but she would not say. The Imperial Capitan was watching him from its place on the mantel, where he had left it after dinner the previous night. On seeing it, Emil felt a rush of such shame. How many seasons had he gone to the terrace, willing the snowdrops to stay beneath the earth? Now he dragged them up with his hands, desperate for winter to end. The necessary tools were in his workshop. With a scalpel blade he opened the flower's head, spread back its unripe layers. A little paper, a little felt. His fingers had painted such delicate things on the faces of his soldiers that surely they were up to this task. He worked quickly. He worked with purpose. He locked the magnifier to his eye and hunched over. And then when he heard footsteps behind him, then when he was holding himself so tight he felt ready to burst, then he was finished. He turned round to find Nina waiting. Her belly was rounded, his two sons grown firm. "They're ready for you." Emil strode across the workshop, squeezing her hand as he brushed past. Out on the shop floor the shop hands were nervously milling. Kathy lingered, unseen in the darkness, watching him keenly. Emil shook as he lifted his fist, opening it to reveal the snowball bulb with its flower standing tall and firm. "It's over," he said. "Finished. We'll see you all next year." A month had passed by the time real snowdrops filled the Emporium Terrace. Kathy wove them into Martha's hair. Papa Jack retired for his long summer sleep. Caspar continued his tinkering, and down below, locked in his workshop day and night, Emil opened up the soldiers that had once been his, removed their mechanisms and took them apart piece by piece. Scalpels he had at his side, screwdrivers and tweezers and wrenches small enough to shift the most tiny of cogs. He lifted out springs and stretched them, looking for faults in the coiling. He put his magnifying glass to the teeth of the wheels that drove the pistons that drove the soldiers' arms and legs. He dismantled and rebuilt and dismantled again, and still he couldn't discern by which simple trick of engineering Caspar had corrupted his long war. "What am I missing?" he said to the Imperial Capitan, sitting static up on the shelf. "What did he do?" Spring was here, the days already growing longer. They would, Emil decided with a sinking finality, all have to be destroyed. All of those hours spent at his workshop lathe, all of those unsuspecting toy soldiers put to the torch so that he could begin again. He was scratching out figures on a slate, trying to quantify the amount of timber he would need, the number of shop hands he would have to hire to replenish the shelves by the time Christmas came, when fists hammered at the workshop door. Behind him, Kathy hung in the frame, gasping for breath. "Emil, you must come." "I'm nearly there, Kathy. Whatever he's done, I'm certain..." "No, Emil, now. It's now." Emil was slow to understand. He began to protest. This was his time. All he needed to do was think. The answer was here, if only the world would let him find it. But then Kathy's silence revealed all. He dropped his pencil to the worktop, watched it roll down to the feet of the Imperial Capitan. Then he was up on his feet, finding neither his words nor his balance. "Now? But Kathy, there's a month, 2 months to go." "It's twins, Emil. The midwife said they'd come soon if they're twins." Emil stuttered out onto the shop floor, stumbling over himself as he twirled to look at the galleries above. Perhaps it was only imagination, but he thought he could hear Nina, even all that distance away. Kathy took him by the hand. "Now," she said more firmly. They reached the Godman's quarters by the back stair, the one that couldn't possibly have climbed so high into the rafters as it did. Martha hung by the terrace door, standing on the tips of her toes. Papa Jack clasped his hand as he came. Mrs. Hornung, or so Kathy said, was already by the tradesman's entrance, awaiting the arrival of the midwife. And Caspar... well, Caspar was behind one of those doors, his head in a manual, oblivious to the nephews about to make their entrance to the world. Nina waited alone in their bedroom. When Kathy left, she had been prowling back and forth. Now she sat on the edge of the bed, trying to ride the early contractions. In the passage outside, Emil stopped dead. "Kathy, I don't know if I can." How his heart must have been pounding. Kathy stood as close to him as a wife ever could and whispered, "You've been waiting 11 years. You were ready to help me then, and you're ready to help her now. Don't you remember? All of the books you collected, all of the questions you asked. Emil, not once then or now did I doubt you could do it. Just go in there, hold her hand until the midwife comes. Tell her you love her. She's going to need it." Emil whispered, "Thank you, Kathy." And then he was gone through the doors. 7 hours later, there was cheering in the Emporium halls. Kathy, who had waited so anxiously while Emil paced the quarters, panicking each time the midwife emerged to collect more towels, more water, toast and butter to give his wife strength, heard the squawking of a newborn through the wall and breathed out. Until that moment, she had not known she was holding so much tension within. At her side, Emil was suddenly on his feet. Should I go, Kathy?" There were two voices crying now. She was certain of it. The midwife would already be swaddling them. Nina would already be... Mrs. Hornung appeared in the doorway, her sleeves still rolled up as if she herself had been there at the bedside. "They're asking for you, Emil. It's time." But he was rooted to the spot, and until Kathy put her arms around him and whispered that his work was about to begin, he did not dare take a step. After he was gone, Martha clung on to Kathy's hand. "Can we go, Mama? Can we see them?" Kathy made her wait. She remembered the exhaustion that came afterwards, the feeling of plunging back to earth from that other world where all that existed was the breathing, the body put to its only real purpose. It was not until darkness had fallen and the shop floor lit by the halos of Papa Jack's falling stars that she caught a glimpse of her nephews for the first time. Emile had carried them, tiny as twins often are, out onto the gallery, where they might sneak their first look at the shop floor. He was whispering to them as Kathy approached. "We'll set it right, the three of us, and there'll be stars falling every opening night, just like there are now, stars for the two of you. There's the cloud castle where we'll camp, and there's the paper forest where we'll go hunting patchwork deer, and there's the glade where we'll play our long war, all three of us together. They'll come at Christmas and try to take us on, but nobody will ever win a battle, not against us Godman boys." Kathy was almost at Emile's side, and now he looked around. "Kathy," he beamed, "they're boys. Come over, come and meet my boys." On the first day of summer, Kathy watched from a gallery high above the shop floor as Emile opened the emporium doors and a gaggle of shop hands she had not seen before tumbled within. Demanding their silence, Emile produced a flurry of papers, took signatures from each, and marched them into the aisles. In the last weeks he had given up tinkering with the toy soldiers, and devoted himself instead to reordering the shop floor, erecting barricades along the apexes of aisles, planting secret doors that would entrap all but the most ardent cartographer in an infinite loop. The next season's creations had been left to Papa Jack, who slept most nights in his workshop, enduring this family feud with the same stoicism that had once helped him survive a frozen prison camp. And all the while Emile conspired. Kathy watched as he marched the new shop hands into the copse of paper trees, and once in their heart, to the Wendy House door. Kathy had seen Mrs. Horning provisioning it. It had bunk beds stacked seven high, sacks of potatoes and crates of canned beef, tea leaves enough to quench the thirst of an army, and mint cake enough to sustain an Antarctic expedition. Only now did she understand what it was for. Alone, she saw Emile march the new shop hands inside, and later that day, as she and Martha worked the shop floor, she saw the boards that nailed the door shut, the blood-red sign screaming, "Keep out!" and the crude patchwork wolves that had been set to prowl the perimeter as guards. Unsophisticated things, all they knew to do was march and bark. Later that night, she stood at the workshop door as Martha sat at Casper's feet, learning the intricacies of patchwork design. "And he's locked all the soldiers up in there," Martha was saying, darning an eagle's feathers. "And his new shop hands, they'll undo everything you did, Papa. And how will we ever get in? Because Uncle Emile's turned it into his fortress." Casper's face creased with some memory half forgotten. "Let me tell you something, little Martha. When Emile and I were boys, he simply couldn't bear to lose. He'd build fortresses back then as well, but there was always a way in." "There really isn't, Papa. Mama and I marched all around, even when those wolves had wound down. He's put boards across every window. Those shop hands aren't coming out until opening night, and by then it will already be too late." It was strange to see how buoyed the bad news made Casper. In a moment he was up on his feet, dancing an ungainly two-step as he dislodged a wooden crate from one of the counters. This he set down by Martha. "See?" Inside the box were toy soldiers and parts of toy soldiers. He set one down and, closing the cavity in its back, instructed Martha to wind it. A second he began to tinker with. "I've been holding it in my mind for so long. Sometimes all it needs is time and a puzzle works itself through. But I perfected it last night. It doesn't matter a jot what Emile does in those Wendy House walls, not when..." With a final exhalation, Casper snapped shut the mechanism in the second soldier and wound it up. For some time, nothing miraculous happened. Then, as Kathy watched, the first soldier, which had been marching in ever-decreasing circles, began to wind down. As it neared its end, the second soldier, still with life left in its mechanism, approached the first, took its key in its wooden hands, and began to turn. Energized again, the first soldier sprang back to life and continued its dance. Martha clapped her hands in delight, just as the second soldier's mechanism began to slow. This time the first came to its rescue, winding it back up. When minutes later its own mechanism slowed once more, its comrade sprang to its defence. The soldiers marched on and on and on. As long as they were with each other, they would never stop. Emil never learned how to think. He's good at what he does, that much is true, but he can never think beyond it. He doesn't understand. Perhaps he never will. But these soldiers don't have to do his bidding anymore. Not if they can wind each other up. They don't have to fight in any long wars. Why, they don't have to be soldiers at all. They can take control, be whatever they want to be. My Martha, the world is bored of armies. It can't bear another boy to die. It doesn't need killing. It needs farmers and tinkers, shepherds and railway men and grocers. It's time we set the soldiers free. Oh, yes, Papa. Oh, yes. Martha dove into the box and plucked up another soldier to set it marching with the rest. This one's mechanism had not yet been doctored, and it knew nothing of winding up its comrades. And yet, when it wound down, the others sprang to its defence, keeping it running long after it ought to have stopped. You see, grinned Caspar, that isn't soldiers killing each other just because they ought to. That's people helping each other just because they can. Isn't it a beautiful thing? A Report on a Most Miraculous Thing by Martha Godman, aged 11 3/4. The topic I am to write about this week is what I wish to be. Do I wish to be a schoolteacher, or do I wish to be a mother? Do I wish to be secretary to a rich financier, or do I wish to be a lady explorer? The question set is interesting in and of itself, but, Martha licked the tip of her pencil here, certain that Mr. Attlee would disapprove, a more interesting question presents. How to get what one wants with reference to toy soldiers of Emporium design. What if one was trapped in a circumstance of which one disapproves? What if one was made to be a way one did not wish to be? How might one take charge of one's own journey through life? Destiny, we have been taught, is resolute. But what if one wishes to change one's God-given destiny? Step the first. It is the directions, assumptions, and privileges of others which keep us in place. Point first. A toy soldier must be wound at all times or else perish. Point second. If a toy soldier can be shown to wind himself, he need never rely on the privileges of others. Step the second. Helping oneself is nothing if one does not help others. A movement can only succeed when what is revolutionary becomes that which is ordinary and accepted. Point third. If a toy soldier can be shown how to help others wind up, they too can be released from shackles. Point fourth. Soldiers released from shackles can release others from shackles. As we are taught disease spreads from hand to hand, so too does knowledge and freedom. Step the third. A journey is begun. Who knows where it might lead? The first step is to learn governance of the self. Soldiers do not want to be soldiers, and if you give them the chance to decide, the most miraculous things will manifest. Composition by Martha Godman, August 1918. Kathy put down the paper and felt Mr. Attlee's eyes considering her above the bronze of his pince-nez. It didn't matter how old you were, a schoolteacher's gaze would always be withering. Am I to imagine she is making some veiled analysis of women's suffrage? We have covered as much in lessons, and your daughter has never been less than forthright. But all of this, understanding what one wants, casting off shackles, rewriting one's own destiny, your daughter is, dare I say, a little young for radical politics. And this business with toy soldiers, some risque comment, I imagine, on conscientious objection. Her, with a father who sacrificed so much to keep this country free. Kathy hung her head. Quite apart from anything else, this egregious use of capital letters is alarming. I am certain she does this just to spite me. Of this, Kathy was quite certain. She had caught the girl practicing the most ostentatious capital letters by torchlight in bed. I'll speak with her. See that you do, Mr. Attlee declared, gathering his papers. It is for her own good, Mrs. Godman. Goodness knows, I admire this place. I'm grateful for my years of service, but have you ever thought that perhaps, just perhaps, Martha might benefit from some exposure to the real world? Kathy waited some time until Mr. Attlee had taken his leave before she set out to find Martha. Mr. Attlee had set her arithmetic problems to work through before his next attendance, but as ever she was not to be found with her books. Kathy found her in the Godmans' quarters instead, fussing with one of the twins while Nina tried in vain to spoon stewed apple into the other. At 6 months old, they were developing the same ursine look as their papa, the same paunchiness, too. Martha, a word. No, Mama, he doesn't have words. It's only babbling. He just makes sounds. Kathy thought, it's as if Caspar truly is her father. The knowing look, the deftness of tongue, she gets it all from him. A simple glare compelled her to set the youngest Godman down and come to her mother's side. Retreating to the corner, Kathy unfurled the report over which Mr. Attlee had remonstrated and asked her, "What does it mean?"
"It's all true, Mama. I wouldn't tell lies."
Kathy thought she wouldn't. The truth delights her too much. "But what is it?" she asked.
"It's the soldiers. Papa will show you. Come on."
Martha took her hand and led her up the back stair. At the top, the door to Caspar's workshop sat forever ajar. Caspar was sitting in the rocking chair that once belonged to Papa Jack, while dozens of self-winding men were lined up in battalions before him. Somebody had been making tallies on a board with chalk. The workshop floor was a parade ground, where units turned and fell over, picked themselves up and formed rank and file again. Across the parade ground, whenever a soldier began to slow, one of his compatriots would twirl around, fit his hands into the grooves chipped into the key at his back, and wind him back to full strength. It was, Kathy thought, like watching the dancing of honeybees. The wind-up army moved as a swarm, or not at all. Caspar was keeping metronomic rhythm with his foot. But when Martha started tugging on his sleeve, he looked up.
"Kathy," he said, "look, they're drilling. We've been trying to persuade them to drill differently. Why should they stand in battalions if they're not to be soldiers anymore? But it's bred into them, something in the way that they're made. So look."
Caspar's hands revealed a mountain of miniature overcoats, woolen jumpers and shirts, tiny Wellington boots in forest green and navy blue. Dress as a soldier, and perhaps you're a soldier. But dress as...
"It hasn't worked," Martha chipped in. "They don't let you put them on."
And then we thought, why should they? They've been being told what to do for far too long. Who am I to tell them how to dress? Oh, Kathy, they do the most remarkable things. Kathy, they can learn. Kathy crouched down. At the sudden intrusion, the toy soldiers formed ranks and routed, reforming on the other side of the workshop floor. "They need a leader," said Martha. "Sometimes they just whirl and twirl and collide with one another, or end up shaking hands. If they had a leader, they might smarten up a little. That's what we think." It's like nothing else in the Emporium. They perform the same action 100 times, and for every 100 times, one will go wrong. Perhaps it upsets them, so they simply try over again. But when it offers them an advantage, Caspar's eyes sparkled like frost. All year they've been discovering new things. Caspar opened up a box by his side, one emblazoned with the insignias of the Long War, and set down a static soldier. Moments later, the battalion marched forward to where it lay. From here on, their drill was deftly orchestrated. The soldiers worked in two groups, one to open up the cavity in the soldier's back, and another to make sure the first group never wound down. The soldiers, tasked with attending the static soldier, moved with nuance that had not been possible one winter ago. They reached in and upset gears, lifted out a cog to replace it with three of smaller design, shortened the camshaft, and inserted more guide wires into the soldiers' arms. When they were done, they wound their new brother up for the very first time. Soon, he had taken his place in the battalion, and, to Kathy's mounting surprise, was winding up the fellows around him with newfound aplomb.
"You built them to build each other."
"It's better than that," beamed Martha. "Papa didn't build them this way at all. They built themselves." Emile was diligent in releasing the new shop hands at the end of each summer night. First locking the Wendy House door behind him, he lined the workers up among the paper trees and ran his hands over each, searching for what blueprints or implements they might be stealing away, then marched them in file to the Half Moon Hall. If any minded the way he emptied their pockets, they did not say it. Men returned from war with only half a leg, or mothers raising their children alone needed what work they could find. And as Emile released them into Iron Duke Mews each night, he reminded himself, "They are not your friends. They are not your friends." They were his workers, that was all. And this seemed the most important lesson of his life. Tonight he locked the door, made one last circuit of the boarded-up Wendy House, and walked back through the paper trees. There, waiting for him where the forest met the shop floor, was Nina. Their sons squirmed in their pram, angling for a look at their father, and Emile dropped down to rub his bristly face in theirs. "How is it?" Nina asked. "The finishes aren't right, but there's time for that yet. Still 2 months until first frost might come. We've boxed up enough to fill the shelves, but they need paint and lacquer. Only I can do that." Another night he might have seemed defeated, but on this night he was filled with hope. "We'll be ready. If there's an armistice this winter, it will be out there in the world, not here in my emporium." Emile squeezed Nina's hand, her fingers threaded through his. "Our emporium." They walked together through aisles that would soon live again, past the long war glade that would soon ring with the sounds of battle, and as they went, they were so caught up in talking about the way things would be, the first opening night their sons would ever see, that they did not realize there were already toy soldiers walking across the shop floor, watching their every move. They did not see the wind-up army that marched in the cavities along the bottom of the shelves, did not see them stopping to wind each other up as they came. If only they had looked behind them, they might have seen the army as it marched into the paper trees, turning circles around the Wendy House, where more of their kind were being chipped out of branches and trunks. Emile did not see the soldiers as they fanned back into the aisles, looking for others of their kind. He was already carrying his children up the stairs to bed, by the time they discovered the aisle with his old workshop waiting at its end. So he did not see them venture in, and he did not see them venture back out, carrying one more inert soldier between them. If he had, perhaps things would have turned out differently for Papa Jack's emporium. For there, on the shop floor, the toy soldiers lay down the Imperial Capitan. So regal and strong, so perfect, the leader for which, or so Martha believed, they cried out. They gathered about him. They could not have been admiring, because their minds were only useless blocks of wood, and worked in pairs to turn him over. And there, as in Casper's workshop above, they opened his insides, lost themselves in industry, and finally wound him up. The Imperial Capitan picked himself up. There was something different about the way he lifted his arm in the salute for which it had first been made. Something different in the way that, when one of the soldiers beside him began to wind down, he stepped forward and wound him back up. The Imperial Capitan stood where he belonged, at the head of the army. The wind-up host marched on, and not a soul in the Emporium saw it. So not a soul in the Emporium believed. Kathy always knocked before she entered Papa Jack's workshop. It was a habit she meant never to shake. It had been a long time since crossing that line made her remember the frightened girl she had been when she first came here. But something of that feeling returned tonight. She did not wait for an answer, but stepped directly through. Papa Jack was in his chair, where he always was. She had thought to find him stitching more feathers into the hide of his phoenix. The feathers so often failed to survive the bird's conflagrations, then the mechanism lived on. But instead he was asleep, his fingers twitching in whatever dreams of wilderness and winter still plagued him. He opened his eyes before Kathy came to his side. That was a habit from those wilderness days as well. How has it been? The spectaculars of opening night had diminished in the year Caspar left for France. It had seemed to Kathy an echo of the loss she had been feeling. For how could the Emporium ever be as filled with enchantment as when Caspar walked its aisles? But in truth, it had been because of shipments not reaching London's wharves, and merchants biding their time while prices rose and fell. In the winters since, Emile and Papa Jack had spent long nights lost in each other's counsel, seeking a way to dazzle and delight even in these austere times. What did it matter what commodities were at hand? Papa Jack had insisted. Once he had been a toy maker with only leaves and lengths of twig, and weren't those toys every bit as fantastic as the things that brought people to the Emporium 20 years later? Tonight had been testament to this, the most muted opening night in the Emporium's history, but the joy in the aisles had been of a different pitch than ever before. First frost had come on the night of the 10th of November, and rumour had it there was an armistice in France that, this time, all of their boys truly would be home by Christmas night. It was a special kind of chaos, just as it always is. But she did not tell him how the long war was already off sail, how Emile had filled the shop floor with his recast soldiers, only to discover hours later that the glade had been pillaged, every box opened and emptied, the toy soldiers he had slaved over all summer gone. She left out the moment Emile tore into Caspar's workshop and demanded to know what he had done, even though Mrs. Horning insisted he had not left the workshop all morning, and, indeed, had been asleep for almost all of opening night. Perhaps Papa Jack needed no protection, not even in his old age, but those things did not seem right somehow to mention. Papa Jack, listen. There's something I have to ask. It's going to sound foolish. I hope you don't take me for a fool. Sit, Kathy. We've talked about so much, you and I. Kathy sat at his side. Now that I come to it, it seems a question Martha ought to be asking, not a grown woman like me. But Papa Jack, is it possible? I mean to say, might it be possible that a toy might... Now she knew it truly was foolish. She had never been as foolish as this, not even as a child. Come to life. Oh, we read about it in books. There are always puppets growing into real-life boys. And of course they came alive in the imagination and that. That's where a toy truly lives. But I don't mean that. I mean life. I look at Sirius and I wonder. Papa Jack had taken Kathy by the hand. She flushed to look at him, so foolish did she feel. I've wondered too, my girl. Of all the patchwork dogs and cats and wolves and bears we've sent out into the world, what sets Sirius apart? He was made the same way, made with these same hands. And he lifted them up, like a magician might do to show no tricks. Sometimes you see understanding in those black button eyes, and no cogs and gears could ever account for that. So what, then? What might it be? My boys, and now you, have kept Sirius wound since the moment I made him. Windown has never come to that poor patchwork dog. He just keeps going and going. They show him new tricks, and soon his gears strain to mimic them. They take him new places, and his paws record the way. They poured their teaching into him without even knowing that was what they were doing. And with every new trick he learned, every new habit, well, knowledge grows. The braille cards in his motors that tell him when to walk, or when to run, when to sit up, or when to wag his tail, they get imprinted with more and more knowledge. And then, why then, mightn't that knowledge rub up against itself? Mightn't one piece of knowledge touch or complement or clash with another? Suddenly, it isn't just a list of tricks. It's a way of comparing one trick to all the rest. And maybe, just maybe, things begin to mesh. Maybe that meshing is a kind of intellect. These things are more mysterious than a mere toy maker could hope to account for. But sometimes, when I look into those black button eyes... Papa Jack paused. It would feel like murder to let him wind down, would it not? Kathy nodded. You cannot murder what never lived. So isn't that life? As if knowing he was being spoken of, Sirius sidled into the room, snouted at Kathy's hands, and curled up right there on her lap. The shop hands have been complaining. Complaining about scuttling in the walls. They think we've got mice or rats, and of course we do, because this is London and... Kathy lost her train of thought. What you say about Sirius, is it possible it might happen to other toys? More quickly than you've said. She took a deep breath. To give voice to it was to make it manifest. Emile's soldiers. Casper changed them so that they can wind themselves. He did it out of spite, because Emile wouldn't listen any more, not when Casper tried to tell him what it was like to be a soldier and have no control over what you do, where you go, who you are. But since then, they're changed, and changed again. Martha showed me them drilling. They took an ordinary soldier and turned it into one of their own. And now, she thought, the glades of the Long War brought to ruin. All of the hundreds Emile crafted all summer long, all of the thousands. Toy soldiers proliferating up and down the Emporium aisles. Emile had ordered the shop hands to lay barricades across the seventh aisle, to shut the snowflakes there. And she couldn't escape that feeling. The scuttling in the walls, it was nothing to do with mice. Papa Jack was staring. She thought he would speak of the soldiers, but instead he said, "How is my son? I want to talk to him about it. We used to talk. The physician says he has to, but he won't. This thing with the soldiers, at first I thought it might help, but now..." She steadied herself, tracing the blue veins on Papa Jack's palm. "I'm going to speak out of turn, Papa Jack, but you're the one who showed it to me, so perhaps you won't mind. All that time ago, when they dragged you into the East, when they chained you up with men like Chichikov and Urs the Major, and all the rest, it did something to you. It could have killed you, here, inside." She lifted her hand from his to touch him on the breastbone. "But you came home from it. You survived." Papa Jack whispered, "But not the same. Never the same. It all does something to you. The little things as well as the big. You might go to sleep one person and wake so slightly different, and all because of a dream you had. You can't hope to go back. Men lose themselves trying it." And Kathy thought, those music boxes, the ones Casper tinkers with even now, even Kathy had felt the pull of the past, wanting to drag her down, wanting to immerse her. "Might you speak with him, Papa Jack? You're his father, perhaps he'd listen." Papa Jack said, "I'll try." When Kathy got to her feet, Sirius followed. By the time she was halfway across the workshop, Papa Jack had closed his eyes. The worry was sloughing off her with every step. That was what Casper needed, she thought. Only to talk. As she stepped into the hall, Papa Jack stirred. "Kathy," he called out. She turned around to face him. "I haven't forgotten how you stood here in front of me that day you first arrived. Even then you understood our emporium, though you didn't know it. But can a toy come to life?" "My dear," he breathed, "it isn't foolish at all. All of the magic, all of the love we pour into them. I should think the only foolish thing is to wonder why it doesn't happen all of the time." Sleep came more easily when Kathy returned to her bed. Even so, she awoke in the pitch black to the sound of scurrying in the walls and her heart beating wild. Instinctively, she reached out for Casper, but he slept on and, in his sleep, cringed from her hand. She trembled as she lit the candle at her bedside, illuminating every corner in dancing orange light. The only thing that moved in the room was Sirius, the bellows of his lungs lifting his fabric hide up and down, and still that infernal scuttling in the walls. Perhaps it was her imagination, but the scuttling seemed to move up and down the walls, as if the mice in the cavities were constantly surging one way and then the next. She followed it out onto the landing and pressed her ear against the wall. Sometimes it was strong and sometimes it was soft, but always it was there. Not mice. There was no point in keeping up the pretense. She took a deep breath and prepared to retreat to her bed. And it was then that she noticed the candlelight flickering under the opposite door, Martha's room. Evidently the girl had fallen asleep with her head in a book, and her candle still gutted on the ledge. Inwardly, Kathy sighed. This was how the Emporium would end, in a dancing inferno, patchwork beasts darting hither and thither, paper trees turned to columns of raging ash, and all because of a little girl who loved to read too much. Quietly, she pushed through the door. Martha ought to have been there, wrapped up in sheets with the old copy of Gulliver's Travels splayed open on her lap. But instead the bed was empty, the covers drawn back and left in a heap at the end. Kathy rushed to the window. The girl had left it open, and the chill air clawing in made the candle stubs dance a wild fandango on the ledge. For a moment there was terror, for the window opened onto a steepled roof, and all that separated the roof from the drop into Iron Duke Mews below was a length of iron gutter shot through with rust. She thought to call out, but the November air robbed her of all breath, and when she turned against it she saw, for the first time, that the closet door was hanging ajar, and more candlelight coming from within. Kathy stole forward and opened the door. Here were Martha's dresses and here were Martha's coats. Here were the costumes Casper himself had stitched that might whisk Martha away to the court of some imperial czar or the pleasure gardens of a Parisian palace. The candlelight, weak as it was, came from somewhere beyond. She parted the coats and crept through. And there, in the back of the closet, sat Martha, gaping upwards with the candle at her side. Martha Godman, what on earth? Martha lifted a finger to her lips, then, "Look," she whispered. So Kathy looked. The wall above Martha was a woodcut panorama from head to toe. The candlelight picked out grooves that had been scored into the wood, shapes and swirls of some primeval design. There were spirals and boxes, amorphous shapes that gradually took on the details of faces. Kathy followed them as they grew, the first just a blob, the second an orb with barely defined eyes, a mouth open wide as if in a scream. There, at the end of the row, the face of a toy soldier was recognizable at last. She knelt down, bringing her candle close to the wood. The artist, whoever it was, had grown confident in the telling. At her foot, an etching showed ranks of toy soldiers lined up against one another. The next showed two soldiers,
crude stickmen with tall, charred hats, reaching out to shake each other's hands. In the next frame, what she could only take for a god, for he was vaster than any toy soldier, towered above the regiment. A second god was drawn leaner, more handsome, where the first was corpulent with eyes of deep engraved black. In the final frame, the soldiers lined up in procession. Kathy doubted herself at first, but now she was certain. The soldiers were winding each other up while, from above, the good god looked benevolently down. "It's Papa, isn't it?" Martha began. "And the other?" She pointed to the corpulent god, the one whose mouth was a wide black vortex. "That's Uncle Emile." She dropped the candle. "Did you do this, Martha?" Martha barely had time to shake her head when Kathy, with a rising panic she did not fully understand, snapped. "Martha, this isn't a joke. If this was..." "It wasn't," Martha protested. "Come and see." Outside the closet, Martha got to her knees and prized back a piece of skirting board from the wall. "They scuttle through here, Mama. I hear them every night. So one night, I got a chisel from Papa's workshop. I'm sorry, Mama, I put it back, I swear, and opened it up. I thought I might catch them, whatever they're up to in there. That's when I found this." The etchings inside the skirting board were not nearly as nuanced as the ones across the closet walls. If the closet wall was a bare tapestry of details and delights, the skirting board was the first foray of some Neanderthal cave dweller, scratching out bison and mammoth on his cavern wall. Kathy took Martha's candle and pushed it into the gap. The sounds within were unmistakable. The toy soldiers might have been no more than inches from her hand. She imagined them gathered together, watching her in the dark. "They're everywhere, Mama. Up and down every emporium wall. It's an infestation." Kathy revolved to look at Martha. The words she wanted to say seemed absurd, but the evidence was there in etchings across the skirting board up and down the closet walls. "It's more than infestation. Is it possible?" She paused, hesitating even now. "Martha, have they learned how to think?" The Forever War. Papa Jack's Emporium, 1919-1924. Emile opened the Emporium door, oblivious to the smells of the London spring. The snowdrops had flowered late along the Emporium terrace this winter, and a month later the circles that darkened around his eyes had still not disappeared. Sleep had been coming to him only in snatches. The memories of the season kept turning in his mind. The obliterated long wall, the barricaded aisle, the disappointed faces of the children who had flocked to their door, only to leave it empty-handed. The man standing in the doorway had the look, like they all did, of someone only just demobbed. Emile invited him inside, and, taking care not to stare at the bright red birthmark that discoloured his right cheek, tramped with him into the aisles. "I can hear them already," said the man. He had a broom handle in one hand and a leather satchel into which had been stitched the words, "Anderson's Exterminators." "There must be a nest. It's the time of year for a nest." "Of course, every time of year is the year for a nest these days. It's on account of the end times. Plagues and wars and infestations. Well, we've already had two, so the third's on its way. You'll see." Emile did not intend to talk theology with a rat-catcher's apprentice, and had already marched on when he looked back to discover the exterminator on his hands and knees, listening to the floor. "Good Lord, there's a fair few. Have you got a sewer running under this shop?" "I'm sure there's nothing of the sort." Impatience came too easily these days. Emile pressed his face into the palm of his hand, hoping to cram whatever insult had been forming back into his throat. "Well, there's something. I can hear hollows. There they are again." And the exterminator, still squatting, scuttled to one of the walls. "Do you mind?" he asked, and before Emile could answer, he was back on his knees, a crowbar in hand. Soon he had popped a length of skirting out, revealing a long black cavity beyond. "It's the most vexing thing. Ordinarily, you jimmy up something like this and see spore. Spore here and spore there, you see? Emil bristled. But nothing. Now he had a torch in his hand and was extending it into the hollow. You get to know the signs of rats in this profession. London has some big ones, of course, but none as big as them we had in France. Nasty black fellows.